Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
What about your toughest teammate that you've played with?
Are you saying toughest and the best? Or yeah, sure. The best, I'd probably go Hodgie. Yeah, Hodgie or Goodsy. Those two for sure stand out. And Goodsy was, I only had him for 2 years, so he would have been my age when he was finishing up. But you could just see some of the stuff he was doing even at 35, 36 was just incredible. And then Hodgie was just a leader that just went about his business, led from the front. And you know, knew he was just going to stand up on the biggest, big occasions.
The words of Lance Franklin as he prepares for game 350 and the esteem in which he holds the man who carries the leadership portfolio on Waitley throughout a footy season, Luke Hodge. Hello to you, Hodgie.
Morning, Jared. I thought we had a fairly big week with the Goey and Bud's 350, but this golf situation has knocked me off my seat.
Amazing.
From a week ago where Rory started to say that he might need a break in golf, and then Phil comes out and said, I don't think anyone will put up with Rory's BS. All of a sudden, they're joining, and yes, well, yeah, taking a very different path from where I thought it was looking at about a month ago.
Yes, it has indeed. And Wes, I had a good piece of correspondence before, is there has to be sort of a bit of wrestling scheduling around when all this comes together. Let's just go all in on this sporting soap opera. Wouldn't it be great if Rory McIlroy and Phil Mickelson get paired together in the first PGA Live event? That'd get some high ratings. That'd get some high ratings indeed.
Well, I think with that as well, Phil, my teammates and myself went over and watched the Phoenix Open last year. Earlier this year. And it was, compared to what you'd seen in previous years, there was a massive gap. A lot of the young players you didn't know before. So having them come back together for the spectators and the viewers who go to those big tournaments, it's a better sight because there's people you watch every day on TV.
Yep. So the reunification of golf, and we'll see what it all amounts to, and particularly in Australia. Hodgie there, lovely words from Lance Franklin.
Yes. Yeah. I think every person I've played with has sort of said the same about Bud. So for him to hear that is quite nice, considering he's played with some pretty special people, and he mentioned Goodsy. But you sort of look back and look what Bud's been able to achieve from 2004 when he was a 17-year-old, very, very raw, skinny kid. And then just the career that he's built over the last 19 years, you sort of sit back and go, he's been an amazing player.
So this is a moment to reflect on all that he's done. With an ounce of luck, the two milestones happen on the same night tomorrow, 350 and to his final place on the pecking order, which will be outright fourth on the goal-kicking table. So if you took us right back, Luke, is imagine a 19-year career from that kid to one of the all-timers.
I think when you first rock, when those three blokes first rocked up, Louis, Ruff and Bud, they were cheeky blokes who knew that they had confidence about them, not arrogance confidence, but confidence that they would be able to match it at AFL level. But what the three of them were able to do for our football club. But then the two, Ruffy and Bud, as key position players, young key position players at that, to sit in later on thinking what Bud's been able to do. But you look at, it wasn't always a smooth transition, or it wasn't a smooth pathway for Bud. Early on, it took him a little while to adjust. I remember his first real big bag was, I think it was early on in his second year. He may have missed early in his second year through a little bit of injury and maybe a little bit of drop back to the seconds for disciplinary reasons, but that was all a part of his journey. But it was probably his third year was his big standout year. We all sort of sit back, and he kicked 73 goals as a 19, 20-year-old player in 2007. And I vividly remember the goal on the boundary line against Adelaide when we'd never won a final, we'd never played in a final. We're coming up against Adelaide. They'd been on top of us all day. And then there was this 19, 20-year-old kid who won us the game. I think he kicked his seventh on the boundary with 30 seconds to go. And then from that, you just knew that big things were going to happen. And then the following year to kick 100 goals, the last person to kick 100 goals in a home and away season, kicked 113 that year, and he was just unstoppable. To sort of sit back as a teammate and watch this young fella who was still learning the game, was still understanding the game, but to be able to dominate with his athleticism and to do it with no ego, to be someone who never wanted any limelight, to if there was people to be spoken about, he would always shy away and try and go behind the scenes just so he didn't get pointed out, because he just wanted to go and play football, and that's the bloke that he was when he started, and it's the bloke that he still is right now.
How will you reflect on having had the privilege of seeing him so close up, both at training and in games?
Yeah, there's so many people look at him and go, he was a talent. And yes, he was, but he was determined and he was tough. You don't play 350 games over 19 years without pushing through injuries. And it's automatic. You just said you sort of sit back and reflect on things that stand out for Bud. And there's two main parts of his game that stood out for me. One was him pushing through injuries. 2011, there was a qualifying final against Geelong where he had severe bone bruising on his knee. We thought he was finished, he wasn't going to play. The physio said he's no chance after the game. He played the next week, kicked 4 goals, and they said there's no way that a lot of other blokes on our side wouldn't have got up from that. And that, I think, showed the mental strength and how competitive he was, that he didn't want to let his club down, his teammates down, in a big final. And we ended up winning that final. And I think the next part probably understands why all the players, when Bud left and went to Sydney, the reason why you did not hear one bad word said about Buzz was about how he put his teammates first in the last two games he did for our football club. So the prelim final against Fremantle in 2013, he had McPharlin and he came in. Sorry, the prelim final against Geelong, he had Lonergan. It was the Kennett curse. We hadn't beaten him since 2008. He came into the leadership meeting and said, I've got Lonergan. Why don't I play him up the field? He's more Bud was more athletic than Lonergan. Deep, probably played into Lonergan's hands. And a selfless role like that in a pretty big game, knowing that you were pretty much going to leave after, if we lost, you're out the door either way. So he's put the team first, played up the ground. He only kicked one goal, but I think we had Gunston kicked 4, Haley kicked 2, Shawnee Burgon might have kicked him with 2 or 3, but it was the mindset of Bud on such a big stage, putting the teammate first. And then the next week was the grand final against Prelim. And the same thing happened. Everyone on grand final day wants to play well, especially if Ford wants to kick a heap of goals. Once again, knowing that he was going to Sydney the next year. And he came straight in, he said, I'm going to have McPharlin. He goes, deep down, he's probably just as strong, just as fast as me in the Ford 50. Why don't I play him outside the Ford line as I did the week before? And once again, his teammates got the reward. Gunston almost got the Norm Smith kick 4. Once again, I think we had 5 or 6 Ford line players that kicked goals, all because Bud played that selfless role and put himself out of the view of kicking goals. And not many people look at that. A lot of people sit back and go, oh, he played a part of the team, but it was his decision for the two biggest games, especially after we were getting touted as chokers. We lost the prelim to Collingwood in 2011, lost the grand final to Sydney in 2012, so people were touting the Hawthorn Football Club as chokers and our group as chokers. For him to put us before himself in those two biggest games, it says a lot about him. So when he did end up making the decision to go to Sydney, there's not been one bad word spoken about him, because deep down, you know that he's a team player, and he put us before himself in those big games.
What a great insight! What a great insight! Is he the most spectacular player in your lifetime following the game?
There's probably two blokes that in my side that I'd play with was Cyril and Bud, who could do anything. But consistency over a long time, I've put him down as the best I've played with and against. And we've through our journey when you went through and you had Ablett and Judd and Buckley and Voss, James Hurd, these kind of guys, played with Shane Crawford as well as a Brownlow medalist. We've been very fortunate, the blokes we've played with and against at Hawthorn. But Bud, for what he's been able to average almost 20 games a year, now move up to number 4 in the all-time goal-kicking playing. He's probably up in the top 20 in the games as well. He's been an amazing person, and as I said, the last person to ever kick 1,000 goals in the AFL system, especially when games that when AFL had turned for forwards not to kick goals, he was probably the only consistent one that was able to do it. I think he'd kicked over 50 goals 13 seasons, which is an unbelievable record.
It might be the last time in our lifetime that we see the order in the all-time goal-kicking list altered. So, yeah, there's a magnitude to what he's doing.
And I think also what he's done for AFL, not only AFL in general, but AFL up in Sydney. Like, so we all know that Sydney's a league. Brisbane and Sydney are dominantly held by league and union. That's slowly changing. But to be there and watch it live, for him to kick his 1,000th goal and watch 15,000 people on the SCG just flood to the ground, and it showed how calm he was when everyone was patting him on the head, and he did it with a smile. But just to show what he was able to do up in a state that naturally isn't fond of AFL, but he had a massive pull in changing the tide and changing people's mindset up there.
It'll be a magical night tomorrow night as he reaches game 350. The wash up to the tribunal, Hodgie. So really, for all the debate that had gone on around Jordan Degoe's incident, it was just a question of would it be 3 or would it be 4 weeks, and it landed at 3. How's it left you feeling?
I was happy either way. I was initially thinking 4 because of the... What we've sort of spoken about with concussion and how we're protecting the players, but you also have to look at the reaction of the player who caused it. And I think he was sincere. And I heard Jason Dunst the other night say, why, if someone pleaded guilty, that you get less time? Because I think what people want to see and what the AFL want to see is if you do something wrong, you put your hand up, you own it and say, look, I've crossed the line. I'm not going to waste your time. I admit to everything I did wrong. I was sincere with my apologies. He got his number. He made contact. And that's what you want to see. That's the human part of it, where you sit back and go, well, he's not lying. And the biggest thing that you hate when you know that someone's done the wrong thing is they try and get out of it by lying and continuing to do that. So the fact that he put his hand up, didn't dive away from what he did, I'm comfortable with the 3 weeks.
And that, I think it sort of helped us get to the moment of that action has no place in the game, and we can all instantly recognise it. So the language around it can be whatever you like. It can be as emotive as you like, but that the pure action has no place left in the game.
No, definitely not. And I think that's where we're understanding that more and more. The dump tackle is being removed and the bump. And I think the other side of thing is, I do feel, because people sit back and you watch slow-mo and you think, oh, look what he did. That was a cheap shot. No, it was a split-second decision where he's made that 50 times a game. And the fact is he made an error on this one. He made an error, put his hand up and owned it. But we're very clear right now that in our game and how physical our game is, any time that you do cross that line, you're going to get suspended and you've got to put your hand up and own it. And that's what they did.
The Carlton scenario, Hodgie, which we've kept a close watch on all season, the idea of friction within a locker room and where a relationship between a couple of players fractures for whatever reason and what the impact of that can be. What sort of insight have you got on that front as a leader in the game?
Yeah. Look, there's two ways you can go about it. And one way, we used to do it all the time. We used to sit back and assess what was going on from week to week, assess the stuff that the coaches did, things they did well, things they didn't do, and we used to go and give them feedback on it, the same as what they'll do for us. And that was the communication we had as a group with our coaches. Sometimes it went down well, Jared, and sometimes you probably didn't get the reception that you wanted. But that's a part of a robust discussion between players and coaches who want to strive for greatness and be good at what you do. What I hope has happened, and if Carlton, some of the Carlton players are a small little group that were animated or frustrated with how they were playing, that's okay to have that, because it shows that you care about where you want to do. But the follow-up from that is you have to go and talk to your coaches, and you can't just say, this isn't working. You've got to have enough common sense and enough understanding of the game to come up with, hey, can we try this? Can we do this? Come up with reasons or tactics on how you think you can get better. Don't just knock on the door and say, we don't like this, we need to change it. You help come up with a solution, go in there with the leadership group and the coaches and say, this is where we need to get better as a group. That's how you grow as a playing group, that's how you grow as a coaches, and that's how you grow together and have that bond. What I hope didn't happen was senior players bitching and moaning about a game style, but then didn't take it anywhere. That's the biggest issue you can have. You can have concerns, but if you don't act on those concerns, or if you start talking on the coach's back, that is the biggest issue for a football club. So fingers crossed the players who were heard murmuring about the game style, they've taken that correct action and gone to talk to the coaches about it.
What was the worst shutdown you ever got from Clarko?
It was post a pretty big loss, and I did hear later on that he goes, I'm glad I took a couple of minutes just to compose myself. So, look, the best part about being in a competitive place is you say things knowing that it might not come across the right way, and as long as it's open and honest and done the right way, it's the same as any other player. I've said some things to Clarko, he hasn't liked it. He said some things back, but deep down, you know it's the right thing, but you just don't want to hear it at the time, and that goes both ways. So let's hope the Carlton players and coaches have had those conversations, because that's the only way, as a player you develop, as a group you develop, and that's the only way you get higher up that ladder.
And then there's the final, there's Friday night footy, and you'll be there for it. So this is the Bulldogs and Port Adelaide. I was really, the frustration with the Bulldogs, which they would be feeling. They are aspiring to be more than they have been. And in the moments that it's been there to grasp, it slipped through their fingers. That wouldn't be the easiest scenario to confront and overcome, would it?
No, especially when there's two games where there's certain games when you go and think, we've got to win this. We have to win this for us to take that next step, to not to prove to people externally, but to prove to ourselves that we are good enough to under pressure. The Gold Coast one up and down, people sort of, we can understand that. Conditions are a lot different. Gold Coast play that really well. But the one against Geelong last weekend was on their home deck, had the opportunity, couldn't convert. They're the ones that you sit back and you're scratching your head as a group going, how can we get better? How can we improve it? And they know that they let that one slip. But one thing we know about footy in today's era, they're still sitting in the top eight, and they've got a run home where they can finish the season off. But they're coming up against a team who we all talk about Collingwood and how Collingwood are rated number one. They're sitting on top of a ladder. But I'll tell you what, Port are sitting second, and their football, their entertaining style of football that I've been watching from Port Adelaide, are not far behind the entertainment that Collingwood put on. I know the Hawthorn side on the weekend was developing and a little bit younger, but the aggression that Port had with that ball movement, I sat back in that first half going, this is some of the best football that I've seen in a number of years, even though it was against one of my old sides. But it's the making of such a big contest Friday night with the mids. Bont, we've spoken about Bont for years, and he's rated this year as the number one midfield. But you look at the other side and Rosie and Butters, have their last month to 6 weeks of football has been as exciting, not only the polish that they have with the ball, but their contested possessions, the in and under hunt that they have as a group. So Friday night, you're looking at two quality midfields and who's going to get the upper hand and help their side win.
Hodgie, we look forward to you being a part of that. Thanks a lot for your thoughts today.
Thanks, Jarrett.
Luke Hodge gets us underway each and every Wednesday. World Test Championship starts tonight. Here's Pat Cummins with us on SEN Test Cricket in the build-up.
Yeah, it feels unique. Normally those other events are at the back of a busy month-long tournament or so. This has been spread out over 2 years. So I think the mystery of playing India in a neutral country is just really interesting. It's just so different to, I guess, a normal test match. So we're excited. We feel like we deserve a spot in the final and pretty excited.
Pat Cummins with Bharat Sundaresan. That interview is on all of our socials. First ball tonight at 7:30. When I really want to get excited, I touch base with Steve O'Keefe. Hello to you, Steve.
Morning, Jared. How are you?
Are we fired up for this?
I am. I'm fired up in a sense that it's going to be a long 6 weeks of sleepless nights. But what I'm anticipating will be some firebrand cricket, and I guess starting off with where some people might think it might end. I guess we're all guessing, or I guess trying to find a place or the significance of this Test Championship final in its second year, of course, with New Zealand taking out the first Test Championship. It's a culmination of a couple of years of Test work where Australia has had a really dominant, I think, 2 years of cricket. I think they've only lost three out of 19 tests. But they come up against an Indian side, which has, I think, been dominant over 5 or 6 years. You know, they've beaten Australia twice at home, twice in India, and, you know, I think are the premier team, even though it'll say that Australia is on top. So I'm excited. I mean, I'm much like the normal pundit out there going, look, where does this sit? Where does it place? But I think, is Test cricket better off for this Test Championship final? The short answer is yes.
That's the bit I'm sure of, Steve, is if those of us who cherish Test cricket want it to thrive and survive and grow, this showpiece needs to become the pinnacle that it's designed to be. And we'll only know in real time. I vividly recall the emotional reaction after New Zealand won it for the first time and how we tapped into that. Maybe we'll feel it when the first ball is bowled tonight, that it is a grand final. And if Australia does happen to lift the trophy, then we'll know, I reckon, that we'll have that emotional reaction to it to understand.
It is. And I think it's something that the players want to get their hands on, is that mace. You know, I do as well remember the fanfare that New Zealand got when they went home. A friend of mine, Will Somerville, had played in a couple of tests during that 2 years and got to travel around to schools. And I think it really does showcase the talent, or as we've said over the last 2 years, how well Australia's been playing cricket. You know, playing in a neutral venue, I guess the next part of the analysis is, you know, who does it favour? Because as we've seen, India's been really dominant in outside of India. They've had a two-all draw series during the COVID test series where they had to play the last test, I think, after a long delay to fit that in a two-all draw. And I think you ask most people, you'd say Australia might have their noses in front. I might be a bit contrarian. I think India, because of that dominance against Australia recently and their form away from home, is pretty consistent. I'm tipping them to have their noses in front, but they're coming off the back of, it's strange, they're coming off the back of an IPL. Player like Ajinkya Rahane has been included into the Indian squad. He's had a fantastic IPL series. It comes in to replace after 18 months of missing out on Test cricket. There's some obvious omissions. I guess Jasmine Bumrah, Rishabh Pant, who's well known to Australian fans, won't be playing. However, I still think that they have the talent and the depth to play. And I mean, I haven't seen pictures of the Oval. I mean, I've seen photos online. It's unique to play a game this early in the summer at the Oval. Generally, it's played at the back end of a Test series. It looks like there's a bit of grass on it. India have gone over with their three spinners that had so much success against Australia, not only with the ball, but with the bat, the likes of Akshar Patel, Rajinder Jadeja and Ashwin. So I think the team makeups are going to be interesting. I think Australia is pretty much locked in their top seven. You know, you'd be looking at Warner, Khawaja, Labuschagne, Smith, Head, Cameron Green, Carey, and Nathan Lyon will play the one spinner, and of course, Scotty Boland being added, just pipping Michael Nassu, whose form's been very good in county cricket. So I'm keen to see how India's makeup of their team is, whether they decide to go with two, one spinner, or potentially even three. I think two would be where they'll sit. And I think Jadeja's form with bat and ball, as well as Ashwin, will see them lengthen their tail. Given that they're coming off the IPL, I think that depth in batting lineup will help if they do get sent in. It's a bit green. They'll be able to counter punch at the back end of an inning. So it's going to be a fascinating watch and one that I'm glued to. It's a different sort of Test series. We've seen in the last a couple of weeks, we've seen England play Ireland in a four-day Test match and how aggressive they went about their cricket in that sense. This Test will be 5 days, but we'll have a spare day or a supplement day to make sure that there is a result. But of course, if it is a draw or a tie, Australia will retain the mace and be world number one. And not only that, they'll fill the coffers with, I think, about 2.7 million Australian dollars, which is incentive enough to play, I think.
Actually, it is one of the quirks here. We did double check this yesterday, Steve, with this exact question, is if it is a draw, the trophy is shared, which is totally unsatisfactory on that front. But so they would share it. So I was interested that the study you've done there is where I found myself last night, is India has beaten Australia in the past four Test series, two here, two on the subcontinent. And then just going back over their form in 2021 when last they were in England is they lost the World Test Championship. And then there were a brilliant series of test matches which got cut short through COVID. So that it had got, it was draw, win, loss, win. And then the fifth test ended up being played almost a year later and was an irrelevance. So India's form in that series was excellent. And I know that was a different English side. So if they do have it over Australia in India and they have it over Australia in Australia, it is sort of reasonable to think that they should be favourites against Australia and England.
Yeah, well, that was sort of my logic and where I landed on it. I do think that the guys, the likes of Mohammad Shami and Siraj, have really improved their bowling, particularly in English conditions. I think Mohammad Shami most recently has improved. I think rather than in India, you're traditionally bowling that back of a length or maybe 2 metres shorter than what you would do in, say, Australia or in England, where you want to get the ball up and swinging because it's a Duke's ball, which is obviously different to the Kookaburra, and you really want to be attacking the stumps, particularly if the wicket is a bit green. But I think they've adapted well. Mohammad Siraj, I think, is just consistently improving at test level, and they've got the backup of someone like Umesh Yadav, who's experienced right across the park. So, they've still got the firebrand and mix of guys like Virat Kohli, who's had a pretty lean 12 months. He scored that 100 against Australia, which I think was his first in 12 months. But Chiteshwar Pujara has been over there playing county cricket. Shubman Gill comes off a very good IPL. Where that sits, whether that hinders or helps, I don't know. that you're walking straight into the test match arena, but they'll be aptly led by Rohit Sharma. And I think they've got a point to prove after losing the last one. India, I don't think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jared, haven't won an ICC trophy for close to 10 years.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Rahul Dravid, I heard him in a press conference talk about, look, we are keen on winning the trophy, of course, but, this is the culmination of, many years of cricket to get to this stage. And as I said, I'm excited at the proposition. We generally don't see one test match series. We don't see finals. And I think as it grows in time, I think people will start to understand the importance and significance and where it sits in the frame of world cricket. And, I'm excited about it. A lot of the anticipation, I guess, when talking to people on SEN or talking to punters and teammates and fellow people, is the anticipation is all around the Ashes, which I completely understand. But, winning this would be huge for Australian cricket to top off, what's been a really successful couple of years. So then winning a T20 World Cup away from home, a thrashing of England at home that some might call void, if you ask Stuart Broad or an English fan. But I think Australia is certainly they're right there. And it's going to make for some fascinating watching.
So run me through tonight's scenario. Australia wins the toss, elects to bat. We've got SEN, Test Cricket on the radio, and Dave Warner walks out to the middle of the oval. Where do your thoughts run, given that he actually got skittled by pace rather than spin in India, and Warner back in English conditions with that debate swirling?
And I think there's some great storylines to come out of not only this test, but moving forward. I sit firmly in the Dave Warner fan camp. I think, we can't underestimate a couple of facts. And the fact is that he performed poorly last time he was in England, averaged under 10, and Stuart Broad certainly had his number. And I think with the technology and the analysis that are available to players these days, there's no hiding any weaknesses and faults in techniques. And if the ball is moving off the straight, which it consistently does in England, generally speaking, it's going to be a challenge for Dave. But I still think there's a bit more left in the tank with him. He's come out publicly and stated when he would like to retire. And I came out and made that statement that I'd like to retire in 2035. It happened in 2023. I was unfortunately cut 12 years short before my prime. So I guess we would all like to write our own cricket obituaries. But there will be a lot of pressure on David Warner, but I expect him to rise to it. There's not too many times. I've played with David since he was 16. And in my opinion, a guy with 24 test hundreds plus or close to has generally always found a way. England has been a bit of an asterisk to that. But I think this will bring the best out of David Warner. I suspect if he does well, that will bode well for the Australian team going up against England. If he doesn't do well, I still expect him to start in the Ashes. However, all eyes will be firmly focused on Dave Warner on his improvements. And Australia's had a pretty soft lead up into this first game. There've been a few of them. Dave Warner's been playing in the IPL. Marnus Labuschagne and Steve Smith have had a county hit out and seem really dialed in on the job at hand that's coming up. But Dave Warner, they've been training in Formby, which is in a quiet part of Liverpool, getting prepared, and voices out of the camp seem that he's his usual self, positive, being the Bull, the nickname the Bull that he is. So I'm expecting him to do well, and that might go against the grain in what other people might think, but I think he's up for a big series. And if he does have that big series, then he will get the home ending or the fairy tale ending, which, to be honest, most cricketers don't get, but I'm backing him to do well.
I hope you're right, Steve. Terrific. Let's enjoy it. What's the cutoff for Tex? I sort of reckon the cutoff for Tex is about 1:30 each morning. Is that sort of fair?
that will be fair, Jared. Yeah. Stop hassling me after 3 a.m. and I'm trying to sleep.
Good.
I look forward to sharing some knowledge with you, mate, and it's always a pleasure to chat to you in the morning.
Good man. Steve O'Keefe there sets us up for the World Test Championship tonight, every ball on SEN Test Cricket.